from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, high-speed rail, full speed ahead. Well, California lawmakers gave the green light to start building the nation's first dedicated high-speed rail line. California lawmakers have authorized a $68 billion project that will eventually link San Francisco and Los Angeles, and the state is now authorized to sell a portion of a $10 billion bond that voters approved back in 2008. But that only covers a fraction of the cost. Where will the rest of the funding come from, and what other hurdles remain? Forum is next. We'll discuss it after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
We got the high-speed rail by one vote. That's the way it is. But it is a continuous movement forward, investing in American jobs.
Well, that was Governor Jerry Brown speaking yesterday about the state legislature's approval of $8 billion in financing for the nation's first high-speed rail line connecting Los Angeles and San Francisco. Opponents are still calling it the train to nowhere and predicting that neither the revenue nor the riders or obstacles up ahead will allow the bullet train to complete its journey to completion. In this morning's opening forum hour, we look ahead to what the future holds for high-speed rail in California now that it has passed legislative approval. And I ought to mention that looking forward to what the high-speed rail will be in the nation, since many, including the Secretary of Transportation, are saying this will be the pathway to more high-speed rail, possibly. Michael Cabanatuan is with us in studio. He is transportation writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. Well, let's begin by talking about there's so many obstacles in the way here, but the big one seems to be on everybody's mind, particularly Republicans, money. We've got the federal money now as a result of this vote, but up ahead, how's it look?
The thing to keep in mind is that California voters approved $9.9 billion for high-speed rail. $9 billion of that is actually for high-speed rail. The other $900 million is for services that connect to high-speed rail. That's all that California is technically committed to. But if you do the math, the project is estimated at $68 billion, and so there's got to be future money coming from somewhere, and the state has said it is not committed to, well, committing any more money at this point.
An estimate of $68 million, which is somewhat flexible. I mean, it could go way up, couldn't it?
Obviously, it could. I mean, I think you can see that with any major infrastructure project, costs rise. The cost on this, if you look at the $68 billion, it's already increased from the original estimate, which was in the $30 to $33 billion range. And, you know, as you do more engineering, as you do more design, as you actually start construction, you run into problems and costs can go up.
At this point, we have Bakersfield to Madera. That's pretty much it at this point, isn't it?
Correct.
So we're looking toward down the line, literally down the line, so to speak, a lot more money, and a lot more money that we don't know where it's going to come from.
Right. I mean, basically, the money that they have now is to cover that 130-mile stretch, which is from Madera, basically kind of the outskirts of Fresno, to the outskirts of Bakersfield.
And litigation is in the works against this?
I believe there are, in the Valley, 4 lawsuits, I think. And there are some there are lawsuits other than in the Valley. And as the environmental impact report for the Fresno to Merced or the Fresno to Bakersfield stretch comes out, there are undoubtedly going to be more lawsuits or challenges.
Michael Cabanatuan here with us in studio again as transportation writer for the San Francisco Chronicle and has been following this story for quite a while now. We're going to talk to some other people. Michael's going to stay with us, and Jerry Hill is the first person we're going to talk to, State Assemblyman, Democrat from San Mateo. Assemblyman, good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you voted for this, and the train goes right through your district, and I know you got some amendments to the legislation. There was concern that you had. What kind of amendments are we talking about at this point?
Well, the main concern that I had, and I think the residents of the peninsula had, were the effect of high-speed rail running through the peninsula on the Caltrain right-of-way. And the two things that were important to me, one was that we limited the train to two tracks. that the consistent, the right-of-way that we have today would be the same right-of-way that would be used for high-speed rail in the future. That was one of the amendments. The other one that was important was, as the first step to high-speed rail along the peninsula or anywhere, you have to electrify the system. You can't use the high-polluting, slower diesel trains, and we needed electrification on Caltrain. And this is something that when I sat on the Caltrain board many years ago, in the research that I was doing then, I could see the benefit of electrification to the system. So I wanted to make sure that there was funding in the proposal, in the vote that I took, that would include and provide the funding for electrifying Caltrain from San Jose to San Francisco. So those were the two major components that I wanted to make sure that were in the bill, and that gave me a comfort level for this phase of the Central Valley. I also, because of the independent utility, the ability for that system to raise the speeds on the line going from Madera to Bakersfield, and the opportunities there, I could see that we were going to get the benefit for the dollars spent in the peninsula, as well as when you look at the $145 million that is going to be provided for new BART trains. And that's something. We have the oldest fleet in the country for public transit is with our BART system today. And we'll also see improvements to the Amtrak line between Oakland and San Jose, which will provide faster service as well. So we're making a $4.7 billion investment from Prop 1A, but we're going to bring in a total of about $12 billion in federal and local matches that will provide greater and better public transit for the Bay Area especially, but throughout the state.
Well, you've called this a pause button. This means essentially that we have to raise a lot of money ahead, as we just found out, to make sure this project goes to its completion. And is there really a realistic business plan?
Well, I think the business plan is realistic, but as I look at it, I voted for the plan and the proposal that was there today, which was spending the $4.7 billion and no more. This was not a check. We didn't sign a check for $68 billion last week. We signed one for $4.7 billion. And if I take that and look at the cost-benefit derived from that amount of money, I felt comfortable with that based on what I was able to get into the proposal. If you look at that in the future, for future appropriations, the qualification or the standard that I'll be looking at is that it will have to be provide the benefit for the value and the cost that they will be requesting, or I won't vote for future appropriations. If we leave it, if the system stops being funded after this first phase, this first implementation, we will have received tremendous benefit for public transit in California. And whether we will see that for the next phase, we'll have to look at that when the time comes.
Still a lot of major questions about that next phase, though, aren't there?
There are. Absolutely, there are major questions. And I think we'll be looking at it when that time comes, and it'll have to stand on its own.
Again, Jerry Hill is Assemblyman and represents San Mateo, is a Democrat from San Mateo, represents the Peninsula State Assemblyman. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Michael.
Joe Simidian is also joining us, State Senator, the Democrat from Palo Alto. We're going to bring him in shortly. But let me go back to you, if I may, Michael Cavanaugh-Dwan. This has had a lot of politics behind it, a lot of Democratic politics behind it. I mean, President Obama's very strong supporter of rail and has been outspoken in his desire to see it take place. But it failed in Florida. It failed in Ohio. Failed in Wisconsin. Here it is in California. As I alluded to before, Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood has been in town. He's been talking it up. Is this going to be a national model? Is that what we're looking for here?
Well, that is certainly what the Obama administration hopes. And Secretary LaHood was out here yesterday, and of course he was singing the praises of high-speed rail and praising California for it. They're wanting this to be a model. And, there are some of the critics would say that it will be a model of the wrong way to do things.
Well, we've been just talking about some of the projects, obstacles that are in the way and that are up ahead. Give us your best sense of ridership assumptions, because, again, there's been so much conflicting data on that, how many riders are expected and whether ridership can actually support this project.
Well, I'm not really the right person to ask about the ridership estimates. I don't have the plan in front of me, and I know that Elizabeth is somewhat of an expert on that.
Well, Elizabeth's right here. Elizabeth, let me introduce her. Elizabeth Alexis is co-founder of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get to ridership, I want to also let listeners know we have Daniel Krause with us, who is co-founder and executive director of Californians for High Speed Rail. Daniel Krause, good to have you. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks, Michael.
Well, what about ridership, Elizabeth? This has always been a thorny question.
It has been a thorny question. When this project was sold to voters in 2008, you know, the estimates were it could be as many as 119 million people a year would ride it. The latest estimates are less than 30 million people. And this has come through more realistic schedules. You know, you're not going to have 12 trains every hour from San Francisco. You'll have a couple trains an hour. You're not going to have the money to go all the way to Sacramento and San Diego. You've had to pare back the system. And still, we think there's issues with the ridership model. I mean, we've done a lot of work on that. We've been surprised that for such a large project, there really was very little oversight for these really critical projections.
Now, you're excited about the idea. It's just the execution and the implementation now that you're
absolutely
apprehensive about.
Yeah. Right. It's like, you know, in Silicon Valley, you can have the best idea in the world, but if you don't have the A team executing it, you know, you're going to pass on it.
Your concern now is maybe not clear if the request of the legislative met requirements on the bond measure are going to come through?
Well, that's one issue we have. When voters passed the bond in 2008, there were a bunch of strings attached to the money, including the fact that you shouldn't be building exactly what they're building, which is this isolated set of train tracks in the Central Valley, which will not be used for high-speed rail until they come up with another $30 billion, until they figure out a way to get through the mountains from Central Valley into Los Angeles. And that's exactly what voters didn't want, and that's exactly what other members of the legislature didn't want, because they know that, well, you can say, well, I'm just voting for this set of tracks, I'm not voting for anything else. They know that once you build such a visible project, you know, it becomes compelling to throw more money at it till you get something useful out of it.
Should they have gone with the French National Railway? There was talk about competitive bidding and partnership with a foreign operator and branch lines linked to I-5 and something really different than what we're seeing now as perhaps a kind of wish list maybe in lieu of a plan.
Well, right. It's a very Los Angeles Times reported this week that the French National Railroad had made a proposal to finance the line, but that they would have to make some changes to the routing to make it sort of more viable and, you know, lower cost, higher ridership. And that would involve just a straighter shot between Los Angeles and San Francisco, maybe connecting branches to Fresno instead of taking the train line right through the middle of Fresno, which has turned out to be very expensive. I think there's a lot of things you would do differently, but I mean the conversation has not been about, you know, the technical engineering decisions. It's been this very politically driven process, and how do you get those votes to get any funding for it?
Well, one of the probably unhappiest votes came from Joe Simitian, state senator from Democrat from Palo Alto. We have Senator Simitian on the line with us now. Senator, good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Michael. Nice to be with you today.
When I say it was not a happy vote for you, I know that you said publicly you had a change of heart and actually almost killed the bill. So it was very tough for you, mainly because of financing. I mean, do you see it the way the Republicans see it, that this is possibly going off a cliff financially?
Well, we joked in my office, my 15-minute set of remarks probably could have been reduced to right vision, wrong plan. That's probably the shorthand for my take on it all. I have been someone who shared the vision of high-speed rail for probably a decade or more, and still think that done right, high-speed rail really is a good fit for California. I think our geography, our population, the location of our population centers, our economy, all of that, I think, makes sense for high-speed rail. But ultimately, what we had to vote on was a particular plan, and as you've just been discussing, the plan that we had in front of us said, hey, let's take all of our federal money, $3.3 billion, more than a quarter of our state money, $2.7 billion, and build 130 miles of not high-speed rail, basically an upgraded Amtrak line, in a low-ridership area, and then hope for the best going forward because there's no commitment of federal funds, private funding, no dedicated funding source. To me, that just didn't maximize our chances of a successful effort over the long haul. And ultimately, I had to be a no vote on the particular plan we had in front of us, even though, as I say, for a very long time, I have described myself as a supporter of high-speed rail done right.
Do you see the possibility, really, of only that segment of rail in the Central Valley without any more federal funding?
Well, I think if you were looking for additional private sector funding, to go that route for a minute, I think the question you'd ask yourself is, well, do I want to build a first system that has low ridership and therefore relatively low revenue potential, or do I want to put my initial investments in a place where there are more riders who can create more revenue and therefore make it a more attractive proposition for private sector investment. So that was problem number one. And then in terms of federal funding, the final plan that we saw at $68.5 billion assumes tens of billions in federal support, which, you know, may or may not ever materialize over the coming years and decades. That's the reason why, if you don't have those guarantees, and look, I've always known this would take a leap of faith, but if you don't have those funding guarantees, then you want to ask yourself, as the transportation people do, what's the independent utility of the thing we're planning to build? You and I would say, what's the standalone value of the thing we're planning to build? Because it ought to have some significant standalone value if you don't have those funding guarantees. And in this case, I thought the standalone value was relatively modest. Again, all of our federal funding, more than a quarter of our state funding, for 130 miles in a low ridership area, and a product that wasn't going to be high-speed rail. It was going to wouldn't have electrification, wouldn't have what we call positive train control, wasn't going to have high-speed rail rolling stock. In that case, I thought, no, if you don't have the guarantee, we ought to be spending it where there's more benefit for more people sooner rather than later in case that additional funding is not forthcoming.
We're talking with Senator Joe Simitian, who is state senator, Democrat from Palo Alto, and who did vote against the appropriation bill that came out of the California legislature. Too many questions about financing, uncertainty of future funds. But didn't you say that your opposition helped bring a better plan?
Well, I think, look, you know, I had somebody say, gee, you must be disappointed. I said, look, you walk on. It's really, in some ways, as complex as it is, it was a vote like any other vote. You put all the facts on the table. You listen to the debate. And this year, about 4 years worth since the bond measure passed. And then you ask yourself, you know, what's best for the state, and you thumbs up, thumbs down. But in terms of the satisfaction of this last 4 years of debate and discussion leading up to this vote and the plan that we finally saw, yes, I think we've achieved a better plan in the sense that we now have protections along the peninsula from San Francisco to San Jose. At one point, there was talk about a 60-foot viaduct and a four-track mega project that was going to go well outside the existing right-of-way. Working with Assemblymember Rich Gordon and Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, we pushed for what we called a blended system that integrates the high-speed rail proposal with a 21st-century Caltrain. That's a less disruptive, less expensive approach. I think that was a good outcome. We also, by making this argument back in December, a number of us, about really, we're going to put all of the investment in the Central Valley in a low ridership area with no guarantees. The High Speed Rail Authority came back in April with some additional significant investment in Northern and Southern California, the so-called bookends. You and I would say the places where there are riders who need some benefit today. And that, of course, means an upgrade for our Caltrain system that serves the San Francisco Peninsula and South Bay. I think that's a good step forward. And finally, you know, we kept pushing. Ultimately, the revised plan, very different from the one we saw in November that we got in April and voted on, is $30 billion less. So less disruption up and down the peninsula, more investment in things that will help folks in our area, and a $30 billion estimated reduction. You know, all of that is a good day's work, but still in all, I felt that the final plan in front of us was one that made me very anxious, and my hope, of course, is that my concerns prove unfounded or that we catch a break along the way and that if this thing moves forward, that it's successful.
You've never more wanted to be proven wrong.
That's exactly right, and as I say, this is one of those times where each member had to vote their best judgment. My best judgment was there were better ways to move forward if you were a supporter of high-speed rail, as I have been. And my colleagues obviously had a different point of view, at least 21 of them, and that's okay. The vote's over, and as we go forward, as I say, I just hope that the concerns that I articulated on the floor on Friday either prove to be unrealized or, as I say, that look, Michael, a lot of this has to do with things we can't see, and that's always the case with a project of this magnitude over a long period of time. You know, as one of my friends said, look, I tell my kids not to play in traffic. Sometimes they still do, and they come home safe and sound, and I'm glad, but that doesn't mean that it was smart to play in traffic. It just means that we got a little bit lucky, and thank God.
State Senator Joe Simitian with us from where he represents us, represents his district in the South Bay. He's a Democrat from Palo Alto. Thanks for being with us this
morning. Thank you, Michael. Take care.
And as I had mentioned before, Daniel Krause is also with us. We've heard certainly a good deal of criticism from Elizabeth Alexis and from Senator Simidian. Daniel Krause is co-founder and executive director of Californians for High Speed Rail. Would it be an understatement to say that you're ecstatic and looking ahead with great optimism, Daniel?
You took the words right out of my mouth. We are ecstatic about the vote. And more importantly, we're very positive that the plan that we have, the revised business plan that came out this April, is a good plan. And because it actually balances a long-term vision with short-term investments that do provide a lot of benefit today. So, for example, Senator Smitty was just talking about the investments in the bookends. We are fully supportive of that. In fact, we also want to acknowledge Senator Smitty's contribution to that that effort to create the early investments there. We're fully supportive of getting Caltrain and some rail lines improved down in the Los Angeles area as part of this program. But I also want to talk about the Central Valley. I'm still hearing some misunderstandings from our point of view about what it means to build in the Central Valley right now. I think Jerry Hill mentioned that, you know, there's going to be a lot of added value to the existing train system. It's not an isolated set of tracks. These tracks will be connected to the north, you know, to Amtrak tracks, and to the south. So Amtrak service will run all the way from the Bay Area to Bakersfield as it does today, but it'll be sped up by close to an hour when you take into account all the improvements that are planned as part of this business plan. And as part of all the money we already have as well, I should emphasize. So we're going to get a lot of value. Also want to say that the Central Valley has millions of people in it, and we believe with a much improved rail system, it will no longer be a low ridership area. It will have much higher ridership based on the improvements that we're going to do. So we see great value with the immediate investments we have today.
And I'm just wondering, though, with all the obstacles that we've talked about, with the concern about lawsuits, and I know that those in your camp and those who are and have been all along in favor of high-speed rail feel probably a lot safer, a lot more reassured about greenhouse gas emissions and just in general better land use and environmental use. But at the same time, I'm sure you can see there are a lot of obstacles ahead, and the biggest one would be funding. You really still very confident that construction is going to begin in 2013 and that the money is going to be there down the line?
Well, construction will begin in 2013. We're pretty positive. I'm sure there will be a slew of lawsuits. We're anticipating that. But what's typical with these projects is, you know, usually they move forward regardless of the lawsuits. Maybe there'll be some tweaks made along the way. But these projects do move forward and they get built. We're building big projects all around the state all the time, usually roads and freeways. Airports, but this time we're going to do rail.
This is one of the biggest ones to come along in quite some time, though. I mean,
no doubt. But we're going to be building it in chunks, so it's more manageable. And we're going to start, you know, again, the 130-mile section of track and then also separate projects as part of the overall program in the urban bookends. And those will all be part of their own EIRs and environmental impact reports and that sort of thing.
Daniel, I want to talk with you more about possible funding as you see things down the line. And we're going to continue also with Elizabeth Alexis and Michael Cavanatwan, who's here with us in studio. We spoke earlier with Assemblyman Jerry Hill and Senator Joe Simidian, and we can speak with you. In fact, you can contribute to this conversation, and we would welcome your calls. Contribute is kind of a heavy word to talk. It's not pledging. It's just getting your ideas and thoughts here on record and any questions you might have. Toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your input and your involvement in the program, so feel free to join us now. 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email what's on your mind about high-speed rail and the vote that went on Friday sanctioning it and authorizing it. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post any questions you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California lawmakers gave the green light to start building the nation's first dedicated high-speed rail line. It's a $68 billion project that will presumably eventually link San Francisco to Los Angeles, and the state is now authorized to sell a portion of a $10 billion bond that voters approved back in 2008. But that only covers a fraction of the cost, and really the central question continues to be where the rest of the funding will come from and what other hurdles remain. And we've been talking about many of them, including lawsuits and
other difficult impediments to bring this into fruition. Michael Cabanatwan is here in studio with us. He's transportation writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and we also spoke earlier with Assemblyman Jerry Hill, who represents the peninsula, and Joe Simidian, state senator, who is also down in the peninsula. Elizabeth Alexis with us in studio is co-founder of the Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, and Daniel Krause with us by phone is co-founder and executive director of the Californians for High-Speed Rail. And Daniel, let me just, before we bring our listeners into this and callers and whatnot, get back to this whole question of money. Where is it going to come from? I mean, to see this project through.
Well, first of all, we actually have more money right now than we anticipated at this point in time. So I think California's track record is pretty good. If we put something out there, we get a good return. But to your question about the long term, it's true. We're in a tough situation politically. We have a situation in Washington, D.C., where there's instability in terms of, you know, where funding's going to come from. But we're confident that infrastructure is going to become more of a priority. I mean, even just last year, you had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce standing next to the major labor unions asking the federal government to invest more in infrastructure. So we believe there's more and more pressure to continue to, you know, invest in infrastructure, and we think that's going to happen soon. I just think we're in a temporary, you know, situation with the way the economy is. Once we are farther along in the recovery, we should have more openness to investing in our infrastructure.
Well, Michael Cabanatwan, let me get your perspective here for a moment, because Newfield polls are showing that one out of five of those who support Governor Brown's tax measure that's on the ballot are now expressing concerns, some of them, in fact, strong concerns, about voting for that because of the fact that here's suddenly all this money going into high-speed rail.
That's indeed what the polls show, and I know that much of the many of the Republican votes against it were saying we can't afford this. The thing to keep in mind is that the money that's being spent is money the voters have already approved. Obviously, there's $9 billion and there's a $68 billion bill ultimately, but of the money that has been approved for expenditure, people have said, you know, maybe that should be spent on schools, maybe that should be spent on roads. It can't. By bond measure, it's restricted to being spent on high-speed rail.
Are you going to add something, Elizabeth Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, just because you've approved a bond doesn't mean you have to actually go out and spend that money, because that money has to be, just like a mortgage, it's got to be paid back. And you know, they play a lot of accounting games. But at the end of the day, I mean, money is money. And that's money you're not spending on schools or parks or public safety. And people are, you know, they're not dumb. They see this big funding gap between the cost of the project and the money we've got in hand, and see that the federal government is not enthusiastic about throwing any more money at it. And they know where that money's going to come from. It's going to come from the voters, whether it comes out of the cap and trade money. I mean, there are other things that people want to spend the money on, and they're screaming off the rooftops. I mean, that they like high speed rail, they want to invest in transit, but that there are other priorities in California.
What do you say to that, Daniel Krause?
Well, actually, if you really look at, if you think about all the jobs that are going to be created with the construction in the next 5 years, there's going to be a lot of new tax revenue flowing into California's general fund. That's what's never talked about. You know, we hear about the debt service, and that's a legitimate, you know, number, you know, in terms of, you know, you're going to have so much debt service for how much you borrow every given year. But the point is, when we create all this new jobs and all the secondary jobs that are created from the construction activities along all across the state that are going to be underway, we're actually going to have a situation where all these new revenues are coming into the state. And the impact is going to be minimal, if not a positive, in the next 5 years.
There is also, Michael Cabanatwan, the fact that voters would have rejected this now, again, according to the polls, if it were up. I'm talking about high-speed rail.
Right. Well, you know, they, as the politicians are fond of saying, especially the politicians who are trailing in the polls, the only poll that counts is the one on election day. But the field poll, and I think some other polls, have also shown that that support for high-speed rail has diminished as the economy has gotten worse, or as the economy has continued to struggle, and also as the project has struggled more and more.
What about the criticism that the route is politically gerrymandered, or has been politically gerrymandered, the train route I'm talking about, obviously?
You know, you can certainly make that argument, and you know, but the route has kind of been the same for many years. You know, it's not as if they've tinkered with it, you know, month by month or even year by year. One of the main political choices was to go through the valley, not along I-5, but along Highway 99, because that's where the people live. I mean, part of the appeal in the Central Valley has been that, you know, if you've lived in the Central Valley, and I have, you know, you feel like sort of the isolated and ignored part of the state. It's a big part of the state, a big population, but you either have to drive a long way in hot weather and on straight, boring roads, or you pay a lot to fly, or you take a train that really is not very fast right now.
Well, let me take a fast train to our callers because a lot of people waiting to get in here. Olin, you're our first caller up. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. A couple of points. One is I would like someone on the panel to point out to me whether there is a rail system of any kind in this country that is not highly subsidized on a year-to-year basis because we were promised ridership things and stuff where we would build in revenue and it never happened. And the other point I would make is that if I go down to Los Angeles on the train, I know I'm going to have to get out and rent a car just to get around that city. And so I don't understand the point of taking a train and then having to still have a car to get around to someplace. It doesn't make sense to me at all.
You want to address those questions that Olin brings up here, Daniel Krause?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, high-speed rail is a very different system than typical rail systems, non-high-speed rail systems. All non-high-speed rail systems are typically subsidized all over the world, but high-speed rail operations are typically profitable all over the world. I'm not talking about the construction part. I'm talking about after it's constructed and your operating system. So high-speed rail, due to the nature of its speed, it does almost always produce a profit. And second, about renting a car, the good news is places like Los Angeles and the Bay Area are rapidly expanding their mass rail systems, you know, urban rail systems. So the great thing about high-speed rail compared to an airport, it'll shoot you right into the downtown of L.A. or San Francisco, for example, and from there you'll be able to connect to many different rail systems. So that's the good news, and we're continuing to expand those. So I think it'll be easier and easier to get around without a car in the future.
Let me thank Olin for his call and go to more of your calls. Let me go to San Jose next. John, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Okay, thank you.
Good. Hey, the reason for my call is I wanted to mention that I really wish people would stop thinking of projects such as this, public transportation infrastructure-related projects, as something that needs to be profitable or whatever, because if that were the case, roads, bridges, you know, things like that would have never been built, and we'd still be in the third world in terms of infrastructure, which we are when it comes to rail transit.
Actually, I'm going to I'm looking at some emails here that are coming in. John, apropos of your comments, a listener down in Sunnyvale named Eamon says, we don't expect Caltrans to make a profit from maintaining roads. We don't expect car ownership to be a profitable endeavor. We invest in infrastructure as a loss leader, knowing that the rest of the economy will come out ahead as a result. The expectation that mass transit systems must make a profit or pay their own way is a glaring double standard in our political discourse. It smacks of bias against trains. Yes, Elizabeth Alexis.
So in this particular case, no one is actually – they're demanding that that it doesn't require an operating subsidy, which is not – should not be an unrealistic assumption if you're looking at the San Francisco to L.A. corridor where people pay a lot of money to take a plane, and there's reason to think if it's fast enough, people will take the train. But we are still – I mean – looking at an enormous subsidy as far as the capital goes to build this. I mean, just the money, the $68 billion, and that number looks like it's actually headed upward already, you know, with the ridership forecast that the High Speed Rail Authority has, I mean, it's going to be where the public is going to be putting up $200 for every round trip that somebody takes between L.A. and San Francisco. So I don't think there's an argument about that, and I hear that a lot. I mean, I think you do have to ask this question that, you know, what are they doing differently in Europe, and what are we doing? How are we doing it in the U.S., and why is it so different here? And I don't think it's about public support. I mean, in the Bay Area, people have voted for basically every transit measure that we've ever had. So it's not about money. We spend as much on transit in the Bay Area as Switzerland does, but we are just getting far, far less for that money. I mean, we think we have to take a hard look at how we're doing things and how we put – We put important decisions, you know, in the political realm and in the hands of consultants.
What are they doing differently over there, Michael Cabanatt? Why, not only in Europe, but in Japan, that makes things, makes the trains run on time, as they used to say about Mussolini.
Well, in Japan, they have a very different system, a much older system. I believe it's now, I think, 44, 45 years old. They have an entire network of subways, trains, buses, but mainly subways and trains that connect to high-speed rail. You can get anywhere in the country. A lot of people don't have cars. It's a different society, too. There's a lot more in the society that is based on the public good.
And that's true probably throughout most of Western Europe now. I mean, the French railway system is really a very successful one, as I alluded to earlier. There was talk for a while about bringing it into this.
Right. No, absolutely. And, you know, certainly the proposal, sort of the French idea would have raised some issues, particularly with competitive bidding and openness and transparency. But yes.
Well, Elizabeth also mentioned speed. And here's Richard from Albany, who says, last time I checked, the whole project has been touted for getting from San Francisco to L.A. in 2 hours and 38 minutes. Considering that the train will have to go through the heavily developed Bay Area and L.A. areas, I can't see how it's possible unless we have the trains go 120 miles per hour or faster in heavily urbanized areas. The fastest Caltrain takes 57 minutes to go from San Jose to San Francisco, 60 miles per hour average speed with four stops. What's the average speed through urban areas, Michael Cabanatt?
I believe they're now talking about with this blended system that it would be about 90 miles an hour. The original plan, I think, called for it to be 150 miles an hour through the urbanized areas. So obviously they've cut that time down.
They've tamped it down. You were going to add something, Elizabeth?
Right. And so the obvious math is that it'll take longer to get to L.A. And, you know, we think you're starting at 3 hours and it's probably going to be even slower because it's not only the Bay Area. I mean, they've chosen a route that goes from San Francisco, all the 50 miles down to San Jose and another 30 miles down to Gilroy, a lot of which is still very urbanized. You're going to have a problem going at 220 miles an hour, which has a lot of noise impacts and some safety issues. And then even through the Central Valley, you know, you're going to be going – they're hoping to be able to go 220 miles an hour through Fresno, through Bakersfield, through a lot of the populated areas in
populated areas that are becoming increasingly more populated.
Though. Right, increasingly more populated. So that's – I mean, you talk about what's in – there was an assumption. Yeah, the route hasn't changed in a long time, but there were these assumptions that this would not be a problem and that it would be cheap and easy and that no one would be upset about this. And that's not the reality. So everywhere you go, I mean, this route just has so much travel time risk. I mean, that you're going to have to slow down through some of these urban centers.
And let me bring Daniel Cross back into this concern that's being expressed. Daniel?
Well, yeah, I mean, sure. And when you look at it, you're talking about the blended system. On the face of it, it seems like it might slow things down, and it will for many trains. There'll be some trains that go slower than others. That's actually always been the plan. You'd have local service that would, you know, stop at every stop and go a little slower. But the plan was always to go about 125 miles an hour max in the urban areas. And even with the blended system, you can still do that legally. You could put down the crossing gates. And all you have to do is move the Caltrain trains out of the way on, you know, there's going to be a certain number of tracks, you know, certain sections where there's already four tracks. So you can put the trains aside and you just plan carefully with Caltrain. And you can move the trains through, you know, on an express train. And you can still, my math shows it can get through there in time. So I don't have the same concerns that I'm hearing from, Elizabeth and others. I mean, there will be slower trains because, you know, when they're operating at rush hour with Caltrain, that may slow things down. But the point is, they can provide the service that's mandated, which is to get from L.A. to San Francisco in 2 hours and 40 minutes. They'll just be selected trains.
Well, let me read you some concerns that are coming in, and we'll go to more callers in a moment. But just an example here of a listener, Bob, who writes, this has to be one of the most idiotic things California has done in decades. HSR is last century technology. There is no over demand now or in the future for the LA-San Francisco route. If there were, airlines would add a few more flights. Problem solved. The environmental and right-of-way lawsuits will tie this thing in knots for years. The fences and walls on both sides needed to protest HSR will be, that's high-speed rail, will be hugely expensive, ugly, and simply a huge scar on the landscape. Not only will it be enormously costly to build, the subsidies to run it will be equally costly. And why not try it first on routes of proven demand like Sacramento to East Bay or L.A. to San Diego? I mean, these kinds of concerns are proliferating, and I wonder, Daniel Krauss, if you can allay some of them.
Well, I mean, there's a certain number of folks out there that, you know, they're having a hard time visualizing how rail can really make a difference in our lives, and it's such a new thing for the United States to have high quality rail. But I mean, if you just have to look around the world and you see, you know, the benefit of being able to tie into city centers, you know, and places like Fresno are going to come alive. This idea that we should bypass Fresno, I've never supported that, because all of a sudden Fresno has access to two large urban areas, as Bakersfield will.
Yeah, we had a listener on the line who was saying Fresno's getting dissed in this whole process.
Well, I mean, based on what's going on around the world, Fresno's economy is going to benefit tremendously, but from having that incredible access to the rest of the state. Right now, they're kind of isolated. It's hard to drive there, and it's extremely expensive to fly there to these kind of locations in the Central Valley. So, and the population's growing. This idea that there's not enough people there to invest. I mean, I just completely reject the idea that the Central Valley is not a good place to invest.
Well, we'll bring some more of our callers in. And Shamar, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on.
Definitely. I mean, directly on that point, the median per capita income in 2009 for Fresno was $19,400. So let's divide that by the ticket price that you guys are anticipating for this high-speed rail. You know, I appreciate us trying to be on the forefront of green transportation and innovating, but this technology comes at a price for riders, taxpayers. Just want to make sure we're getting value for our money and that all the alternatives and the potential development projects that could really in the city and create a more concrete impact have been looked at.
Well, thank you for those comments, Shamar. Good to hear from you. And here's some more comments coming to us by email. A listener named Lou writes, I voted yes on high-speed rail, but I've changed my mind. After seeing technologies like the Google autonomous car and other advanced hybrid auto technology, we should leverage these technologies to serve this need. We would jumpstart these new technologies, make California the leader in what will be world-changing technology, and create jobs here. Building our grandfather's infrastructure is the wrong track to take. I'm hearing this criticism, Daniel Krause, about this is old technology, and you, again, respond to that how?
Well, it's kind of ironic. It's a new argument I've heard just recently that suddenly this really high-tech modern system is old technology when we've never actually had it here in the United States. So it's true, though. We are behind the rest of the world. So in terms of other countries like Japan, they've had this for a while. They've had it for almost 50 years. We're way behind. But so we're playing catch-up, frankly. But this is not old technology. It's expanding rapidly. It's actually improving. The speeds continue to get faster. So they're keeping it. They're tweaking the technology all the time to make it even better.
We had another listener here, Michael Cabanat, one who brings in politics, which certainly has played a role in all this. And Rich writes, "Can any of your guests just admit they get their marching orders from the labor unions on this? Joe Simidian could not be rolled because he is out of the legislature in a few months. Creating jobs at the highest imaginable cost is not in the interest of the taxpayers, who will pay every dime of the cost." A lot of, clearly split, Joe Simidian notwithstanding, who does run the end of term limits here, a lot of split partisan politics here. Michael, sorry.
I can't fairly comment on that. I mean, certainly organized labor has an influence. Other lobbying groups, the pro high-speed rail lobbying groups, certainly have an influence. Taxpayers groups have an influence the other way. I mean, everyone is weighing in on this, and everyone does have an influence. I wouldn't say that organized labor necessarily has an undue influence, but I'm sure people agree, or I'm sure people would disagree on that. I mean, it's obvious that this project will create jobs. It will create the construction jobs. I mean, there are people who say
create
that
a lot of
will,
jobs, actually. Yeah.
I'm sure it will create
a lot
of construction jobs.
I mean, if it can be seen
jobs.
To completion, right?
Sure. And there are people who say, well, look at Japan. There are hotels and there are businesses that spring up around high-speed rail. Is that really an issue of them creating jobs, or is it an issue of where those jobs and those businesses and industries are located? I mean, it's kind of a difficult argument to make.
Elizabeth Alexis.
Yeah, it's actually this is in economics. It's been very easy to see the benefits when you improve transportation for goods, when you lower the cost of getting yourself to market, and it's just been a challenge to sort of understand what moving people faster does, and I think that's been part of the debate. But I mean, we are at such a low level right now. You know, you go back to who's supporting this, who's not. I mean, it's just it's really that complex mix of things in Sacramento, and everybody's scratching each other's backs. And I mean, the biggest proponents of this, of course, have been the consultants and the people who are going to build this. I mean, they're the ones who financed the campaign for the original bond measure.
But it does divide politically, because the Democrats have long been in favor of stimulus packages and public works and infrastructure building, and this is really what this is.
Right. What was interesting is what we didn't see. We didn't see the teachers union come out on one side of this and the construction and the building trades unions come out on the other side. And you have to ask, why is that? Because, I mean, this kind of money will obviously compete for education dollars, and it will. And you have this issue in November where it may sink the November tax increases, which are critical for education.
Noah writes on our Facebook page, is this even legal? They need to break ground this year to get matching funding, yet haven't done an EIR report. And a large portion of the supposed matching funds for the train are not going directly to high-speed rail expenditures. Michael, come on.
Well, they are supposed to break ground before the end of this year, although I've been told that that's been pushed back, that they can break ground early next year. And I haven't been given what a specific date is, but apparently they are allowed to break ground early next year. What the real key date is that it needs to be completed by 2017.
And I want to get read on record here, one of our listeners who says, why spend money on developing another way to burn fossil fuels? Isn't that putting the cart before the horse environmentally? Why not spend money on developing green fuel sources? Well, let me go to more of your calls here, and we'll go to Merced and welcome Ryan. Good morning, Ryan. Ryan, are you there?
Oh, hi. Sorry about that. Hi, Michael. Yes, I just wanted to comment that I just graduated college from UC Merced, and while I was there, I founded an organization of students statewide called I Will Ride. And our message is that despite the healthy discussion that's been going around about funding and route selection and all these other issues, the important thing is to take a generational view. And our generation, our consensus, is that this project is worth it. We're willing to pay for it. We're willing to buy it. We're willing to build it, and we're going to write it. And I think that because of that generational view, that's why the governor has been so supportive of this project.
Okay. Thank you for that. Good to hear from you this morning. And we'll hear next from Mark. Mark, join us on forum. Welcome.
Welcome. Hi. I was just in Japan, and there was a question of how do the other countries pay for these sorts of things. And on our trip, we flew from Tokyo all the way to the southern part of Japan, then we drove up to Osaka, and then we took the high-speed rail back to Tokyo. So we tried all three of them. And the interesting thing that was really surprising to us is that the two-hour drive from the southern part of Japan to Osaka was about $100, over $100 in tolls. And so part of the way of paying for infrastructure is to have very high taxes on the alternatives, such as driving. And I don't know if Californians would be up for $100 tolls for a two-hour ride on the roads, but that is the infrastructure of Japan. So if you're going to compare the high-speed rail in Japan, you should also include the alternative forms of transportation, which are about the same price.
Okay. Mark, I thank you for those comments. I want to go to some more of your comments. They're coming in by email. Matt writes, before I go to Matt, so I want to read actually Stephanie's, who says, I'm a big fan of high-speed rail and believe it is the best solution for regional transit, but mediocre speed trains in a meandering scenic loop is a complete failure of the original vision that most people supported. The project now needs to be scrapped and sent back to square one. A successful project needs to be based on a direct spine between the Bay Area and L.A. Bay to L.A. nonstop needs to be phase one of any project that will be successful. Two stations and lots of straight track. That's the first step on a path to success. Well, Michael Cabanatwan, do we have a plan here? I mean, is this really down in cement moving forward?
The alignment is relatively down in cement. I think it's probably unfair to call it a looping, meandering route. I mean, certainly it skirts around the Grapevine and goes through the desert to get to L.A. And, you know, getting into the Bay Area, it goes over the Pacheco Pass as opposed to the Altamont Pass. And both of those have been controversial choices. But, you know, they're relatively straight routes. And, you know, it hasn't really just sort of looped through things. The idea of going down Highway 99 as opposed to I-5 is that it's supposed to serve the population of the valley. And the population in the valley is located on the east side, not on the west side.
And Matt writes about the implications possibly on other economies. Fewer drivers, less pollution, airline customers lost, retail booms near the stations, and changes that are perhaps going to accrue if this project is brought to completion. Let me get Jeff on from Palo Alto. Jeff, join us. Hi.
Yes, I love high-speed rail in Europe, and I'm just concerned of growing up in the Bay Area, what happened to BART, where in San Mateo they said no, and that really kind of eviscerated a lot of its utility. So I want to see the politics line up as well as the tracks so that this can really become something that people can use.
You want to look in the crystal ball here for a moment? Can we do that with you, Michael Cabanetwan, in terms of the politics up ahead?
Sure. It's really difficult to tell without knowing what will happen in the congressional and presidential elections. But if the Democrats are reelected and if they were to take control of Congress, I would imagine that the idea of freezing funding for high-speed rail would disappear. There would probably be money for that. If that doesn't happen, if there's a Republican presidency, if the Republicans continue to hold power in the House or in Congress, we probably will not see funding for at least another 2 to 4 years.
Well, on that note, and on the uncertainty about funding, which has certainly been alas pervasive in this dialogue we've had this morning and conversation. We're coming to the end of the hour. I want to thank Michael Cabanetwan, who is, again, transportation writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Elizabeth Alexis, co-founder of Californians Advocating Responsible Rail Design, and Daniel Krause, co-founder and executive director of Californians for High Speed Rail. They've all joined us here for this hour, and we were joined earlier by State Assemblyman Jerry Hill and State Senator Joe Simidian. You, our listeners, wouldn't be here without you. Thank you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.